You're listening to a podcast from Blogging Heads TV.
Hello, Bill.
Good morning, Matt.
Welcome to the DMZ, everybody.
It has been one of our longer hiatuses, I think over 2 weeks. I hope you had a good 12 days of Christmas.
Yes. We literally took them, at least from the DMZ. It was good, but it's good to be back in the safe confines of the demilitarized zone.
Now, you were just telling me that, because I wrote, I think the last review of Don't Look Up. There's been like, you know, 200 Don't Look Up takes. I think I'm the very last in the Washington Monthly. But you told me that inspired you to watch it.
Yeah, that's right. Well, and so part of it is I had, you know, I'm a big fan of Jonah Goldberg's podcast, The Remnant. I'm a big fan of John Podhoretz's podcast, Commentary. And they had both poo-pooed it and implied that it was, you know, at least this was my interpretation, at least that my takeaway was it's just, you know, a lecture or screed on environmentalism and climate change, and it's not worth seeing. But then I saw what you wrote, and I was, well, maybe I'll give it a chance.
It's I wasn't that positive either.
Yeah, but I mean, you know, that for whatever reason tipped the balance, and just I have to say I actually really liked it. I think it was a very good movie. Surprisingly.
So there's two ways to talk about this. There's one just to be movie critics.
Yeah.
Did you enjoy the movie or not?
And I
then
did.
And then there's
I
the
did.
Politics of it. So just, you know, here we are, Ebert and Siskel at the movies. you know, Matt Lewis, what did you like about this movie?
Well, first of all, it's a lot funnier than I thought. But it's also got a sweet side. It's obviously star-studded. You know, really, I can't think of a, usually when you throw in too many famous people, it's a bad movie. But in this case, you know, Jennifer Lawrence, Matt Damon, just to name the two primary stars, I would say, star studded. But I think really what I liked about it, and for me, the line between politics and entertainment is sometimes blurred, which ironically is, I think, one of the messages of this film is I thought it was not obviously a commentary about the environment, but a commentary on the news media, on cable news, on the vapidity, the superficiality, the celebritization, and then also obscurantism, and really a commentary on what, you know, COVID, the Trump era, just on politics in general, our culture. I thought it was a really good satire in that regard. And I guess I have to say I went into it with such low expectation. That may be part of why I found myself really liking it. My only criticism is it's too long. I think you could have cut 30 minutes out of that movie, and it would have just been better, actually, if you cut the right 30 minutes. But Jonah Hill, I thought was good comic relief. Is it Barbara Streisand? Who plays the president?
Meryl Streep,
one of those liberals. Okay. She's very good. Anyway, thumbs up from me.
See, I feel like when I wrote about it, I didn't write about, you know, the entertainment aspect of it. Cause I thought, you know, if you like it, you like it. If I don't, I don't, you know, what's the difference? I didn't really like it as entertainment. I have the total reverse critique. I didn't think it was too long. I didn't feel a drag. Like that wasn't my problem. I thought it actually moves pretty fast.
But it is, I mean, just empirically speaking, it's like 2.5 hours long or something.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think if you take out the credits, it's more like 218 of actual movie.
But you can't skip the credits because it's got the
the very, very last scene, I clocked at 218.
Okay.
There's actually a line that I didn't use in my review that I kind of wanted to, but it didn't quite make sense. And I don't have it at my fingertips. When there was the reboot of Arthur with Russell Brand, There was a New York Times article.
I had forgotten about that.
There was a New York Times piece about like the old Arthur and the new Arthur, and how the old Arthur was a sort of quintessential 1980s movie where it just sort of, you know, revels in materialism and Gilded Age excess. And the protagonist, you know, the alcoholic louse Arthur, you know, not only gets the girl in the end, but, you know, because his I think his mom was going to, you know, cut him off if he went with Liza Minnelli. But like he doesn't have to give up the money for Liza Minnelli. He gets Liza Minnelli and the money.
Yeah.
And they initially tried it the other way, and like the audiences hated it. And so they had it in 80s style. They said they sort of give him everything. And the director of the writer said, when you have an ending that doesn't make sense, you want it to go really fast so nobody notices.
That's a good idea. Yeah. I like that.
And I felt like there are so many plot holes and incoherences in the movie that they got away with because they went fast. They just kind of jump from one thing to the next, and you don't even stop to think about it. And you know, I'm not a typical movie. I don't really like watching a lot of political movies because I can't separate political reality from the movie very well. Like the American President. When you watch American President closely, you know, Sydney, the Annette Bening character, she moves to Washington, D.C. and then has a meeting with the president like that Monday.
Yeah. You're like the cop watching the detective show, yeah, saying like, or the doctor watching the ER show saying like, they would never do it like that. I have to say, to me, one of the things so spoiler alert, I don't know if I'm going to have spoilers, but.
Well, assuming it's spoilers here. If you haven't watched it, you want to see it, don't listen to the rest of the
stop and come back. Yeah. You know. But so there were things in there like you know, Matt Damon's character becomes, so first of all, you take these scientists who discover the comet.
You mean DiCaprio? Leonardo DiCaprio.
No, Matt Damon.
There's no Matt Damon in the movie.
Is that Leonardo DiCaprio?
Yeah.
Oh. Really?
Really?
Okay. Wow. Okay. At some point they merged. They used to look so different.
He was a little. He was a little puffy, Leonardo.
Well, he was very. He's gotten very puffy. I guess you could question my entire judgment on the whole thing, based on the fact that I don't know who the protagonist is. Okay. So when Leo, and you know, what's her name?
Jennifer
Lawrence.
Yeah.
Anyway, the two scientists. They're not good at explaining themselves, right? Mm-hmm. They're not good at going on TV and talking about it, like, which I think was itself an interesting point. Why would you expect someone who is a scientist to be good at this, right? So that's one example. Then then Leonardo DiCaprio starts becoming famous and has an affair and it breaks up with his wife. That happens all the time, right? There is that temptation. You start to gain fame. So there were a lot of like little things in the movie that I thought were little morality tales. People, you know, questioning, you know, if you think the end of the world is nigh, does that draw you closer to your faith? Or do you become more decadent saying, hey, let's get it while we can. Let's party, you know, party while we can. The name of the movie, right? Don't Look Up, I thought was incredibly, I think, well done as a commentary on our times, you know, the whole drill, baby, drill, lock her up sort of mantra. You know, basically what happens is Leo sees that the comet is coming. You could see it. And he says, like, all you have to do, if you don't believe in it, because there were deniers who just didn't even believe that this was even happening at all. Right. Another obvious parallel to a lot of things, not just the environment. But he says, just look up. And the other side, you know, weaponizes that, spins it and says, you know, don't look up. And so that was sort of the way that Trump, for example, was able to co-opt the fake news mantra and use it. So for a whole bunch of reasons, I thought it really worked. I thought they struck the balance just right. And Bill, here's my question for you, though. Mm-hmm. Why did I have the idea that this was going to be obviously a metaphor for global warming and environmentalism? Like, was that something that the movie put out, or was that something that critics of the movie?
No, I mean, one of my, you know, one of my biggest criticisms here. I mean, the thing is, I can't watch the movie and separate from the politics because I know the people behind it.
Yeah,
Adam McKay and David Sirota. I mean, I know Sirota.
You know them personally?
I mean, Sirota. I did over with Sirota Campaign for America's Future. You know, we were perfectly we're on fine terms there. He's been a lot meaner to me since. And so we have tangled on Twitter in recent years. You know, I don't have any direct dealings with McKay, although I've liked his past work. Talladega Nights, one of the greatest movies ever.
If you ain't first, you're last.
And I think the politics of Talladega Nights are more cleverly intertwined than they are in Don't Look Up. That's my personal take. But the two of them heavily marketed the film as a climate change parable, and framed it as good guys versus bad guys. The Don't Look Up frame is, the bad guys are making you not look up when you should look up. And I thought
I think that's one interpretation. And if they had been blatant about pushing that agenda in this movie, it wouldn't have worked. It would have been propaganda. This movie raised a whole lot of questions. And I think you could apply some of these things to global warming or climate change, but you could apply them to COVID. Or
COVID came up in the middle of doing it, and so it was kind of in the back of their mind, but it's still primarily driven as a climate change parable. I think the parallels are actually more apt with COVID climate change.
I do too. And I think a commentary on Trumpism, obviously, but not over, but not sort of in your face. I thought it was done well, not propagandish, or maybe the best propaganda is that which seems to be neutral. But I would also say a real commentary on the media. I mean, like, having done a lot of cable news, like they just destroyed like these hosts of these shows, and I think they really exposed the vapidness of that.
Well, here's my problem with that. Twofold. One is, like, if I didn't know their politics at all, I had no idea who was behind it, and they didn't do any interviews describing it, I would have been more prone to seeing all the characters in the movie as flawed, and look at, the world ending as, not to say that not to be falsely equivocal, but there are many mistakes made on the just look up side that you would say, maybe people who want to solve the climate crisis have to be self-reflective and think about what they're doing that isn't working, how to sharpen their tactics. I think it would have produced more of that conversation. But Sirota and McKay have not leaned into that element at all in their own interviews. I mean, if they have, I missed it. Man, I've read a lot of print on what they've said. I haven't listened to every podcast that they've done. So if they have said it somewhere and I missed it, I apologize. But I've not gotten that vibe at all. So I've seen their Twitter feeds. So they don't really get that at all. And the media aspect of it, obviously there's a lot of vapidity in the media. But I think it is a stale argument that the media, that the reason why we don't tackle climate change is because of the media's superficiality. Like, I think that's an argument that's old. The media is a lot better on climate change than it was.
Sure, but so first of all, I would say as a conservative, I think I'm probably more practiced at the art of ignoring the fact that the people who make the art I consume and perform in the art that I consume are liberal. In other words, I'm probably more practiced at blocking out their politics and ignoring their personal politics and just focusing on the piece of art itself and not letting that cloud my judgment. But again, I don't think this commentary on the media, at least my interpretation, has anything to do with whether they've downplayed or ignored global warming. I think this is about the media. It's about how superficial they are, how I mean, the world could be ending, and they're talking to pop stars, you know, they're interviewing pop stars who are like talking about their breaking up with a DJ. They're more interested in the entertainment buzzy stuff than in the substance. And I think that's obviously true.
Well, let me make a point. This gets into more of what I wrote about for the Washington Monthly, and I think it does blend the politics and the entertainment aspect. And this is, I'm going to, ton of spoilers here, people.
this time we mean it.
I mean, I was kind of confused while watching it because I'm expecting a movie about the don't look up forces versus the just look up forces. And that divide in the movie is literally 9 minutes of a 2 hour, 18 minute movie. Most of the movie, there isn't a debate over whether the comet exists. When the two scientists go to the White House, yeah, the president is kind of glib in response. And nonsensically, I might add, because she's like, oh, well, I
focused
can't.
Focused on the midterms, focused on a Supreme Court nominee.
Okay.
Which makes perfect sense to me, right? The world is going to end, but you're more focused on the immediate.
3 weeks before the midterms, you're the president. You're probably going to lose. A crisis? This is just what I need to survive the midterms.
Here's the thing. Well, she does figure that out later, right? I mean, they do capitalize on that.
They do. But so I thought the initial thing, I was like, you're making a premise of this plot that, one, I don't think makes sense. If you have no anything about politics, it doesn't make sense. Now, which, of course, is not unusual for a political movie, because I think there's often things like that.
I think it was plausible, because they're also in the midst of this scandal, so that maybe just clouds their judgment. And also, I think it was Jonah Hill who says, like, every day someone comes in here and tells us the world is going to end. You know, it could be that, which
in my mind is actually, I mean, Jonah Hill's obviously a loathsome character.
Yeah,
but it's not a ridiculous point. You do get bombarded with end of the world please when you're president of the United States. And the fact that two total Joe Schmo scientists even got 20 minutes of time with the President of the United States is set up as like, these people aren't taking them seriously. I'm like, you're being taken incredibly seriously if you got this time.
Okay, I have a quick question. Let me put a pin in it. Do you have a theory for why the general charged them money for free refreshments?
Well, I think they're trying to set up all these characters as being vapid. I mean, you know, DiBiase says in the middle of the movie, like, they're too stupid to be that evil. So they're shallow people who just, I mean, so every choice that I look at as being politically illogical, you can justify as, well, they're stupid. They're stupid and craven and myopic, and so they do stupid, craven, myopic things.
And I found it, I mean, I gotta say again, I found it plausible. Like I get your point about if you were the president, you would have seized on this opportunity to change the subject and to rally the country around this literal existential threat. But the way they did it, I'm willing to believe that that the president and the chief of staff would have behaved the way that they actually did. So they sold it to me, who works in politics, sort of.
So anyway, so the net of the first Oval Office meeting is, okay, they were kind of flippant about it, but as far as like pure substance is, they had their scientists check it out. And what happens? They come back and say, yeah, it's real.
Yeah.
And then they act. They bring them back to the Oval Office ridiculously at gunpoint. Bring DiBiase at gunpoint with a bag overhead to say, you're right, and we're going to do what you want us to do.
That part reminded me a little of like Thank You for Smoking, which is obviously not, I mean, it's supposed to be a spoof to a certain degree, right? I mean, it's not supposed to be 100% realistic. It's a satire. And so,
I mean, it's one thing if you're trying to go for like pure absurdity. But so many people who liked it said, this is funny because it would so happen this way. And there's supposed to be a it's a funny because it's true element to it, which I did not think was there because so many things I felt were not plausible. That's me.
Yeah.
But anyway.
Let me say this about your point about for the vast majority of the movie, people believe in the comet. And then at the end, for political reasons, there's this division where half the country suddenly doesn't believe.
But what are those political reasons? It doesn't make any sense. Why? This gets to, I think.
No, but to me, that rang true. I think Trumpism has done that. Like, even, for example, with COVID, right? Where, like, at some point, on some level, Trump, he's really sending mixed messages. I mean, he is funding and supporting Operation Warp Speed. He obviously is talking to, like, Bob Woodward about how serious it is. And then at some point, like, he's sort of denying it, that it exists. Like, it, to me, that paradox rang true in this weird era of gaslighting and disinformation that we live in.
I think at least you have to have some kind of explanation why they're doing it. Like, it just happens. Just all of a sudden, the president is saying, don't look up. Even though...
It seems like... I think it might have been like a grassroots thing where, like, the president... Like, this started with activists, and then the president latched
on. You see a little teeny weeny bit. There's like a brief, because they have these social media montages.
Yeah.
And which mostly are not don't look up things, but there's like a little bit of that in the social media montage. And then in one of the TV interviews, the Cate Blanchett, Mika Brzezinski character sort of throws out there, we're hearing maybe it's not real. And that's when the Leonardo DiCaprio scientist, has the big, network speech. And then all of a sudden, Orlean is doing this big, all these don't look up rallies. But it's never really made clear, what is the point of her doing that? And so just to put this in chronological order, she's going to do a nuclear strike to deflect the comet, which is what the scientists want. She aborts the mission at the donor's behest to try the comet mining plan, which still requires believing the comet exists. You don't mind it isn't real. He's not saying the comet isn't going to harm us. He's saying, I can beat this comet by mining it and breaking it into smaller pieces.
Yeah.
And then out of nowhere, they go, don't look up. So you have this 9 minutes of don't look up versus just look up, which... And then the Just Look Up people revel in the celebrity. They bring in our Ariana Grande. They have the Just Look Up song.
I thought that song was really funny and really good. I like that a lot.
And then
the big tech part too that you mentioned. I think that skepticism of sort of tech utopianism is appropriate.
Well, right. Well, I want to get to that, but just to close out the plot line here. You go down this Just Look Up, Don't Look Up debate, which ends when people at the Don't Look Up rally look up.
Yes.
And mind you, that debate only starts at the point when the comet is visible. There isn't really a Don't Look Up debate until you can see with the human eye. And then you have that debate, and then they look up and they see it, and then they turn on the president on a dime, which is like people talk about West Wing brand. This is reverse West Wing brand. This is the ideal. This is the Aaron Sorkin-esque. If only the Trumpers looked up and saw it, they would see the light and turn on their leader. And so that happens. The debate is won by the scientists, and then the scientists give up. They don't even try to exploit that. That's when they hightail it to Michigan to have their final dinner.
I think at that point it was too late.
Well, I mean that's the argument you could say. But wouldn't you try a last ditch, blow it out of the sky and see what happens?
What is Leo gonna like? I mean, there were people shooting at it, right, with guns and stuff. Right? Or the one military.
My
guy.
Point is like resolving. The don't look up, just look up debate was meaningless because the plan, in effect, was never reliant on proving it existed because it already was accepted.
But I think that part of the commentary on our current politics is that a lot of things in real life don't make sense. And so I think you're being too. I think you're being too hard on it.
Well, here's why I'm being. I mean, again, if I was to look at it without any knowledge of the creator's politics and what they are saying the movie means, I would be more willing to accept those absurdities and treat that as the point. But what I think is actually the case is McKay and Sirota have a political worldview which goes beyond the is this real or not debate, but expands into how Democrats are phonies and give lip service to climate change while still extracting fossil fuels, and they are in league with the Silicon Valley utopians who are peddling capitalistic solutions that aren't going to work. And they want to lump those people in with the outright deniers and say they're all part of the same bucket. And they didn't want to market the film that way. So they call the film Don't Look Up. They sell it as primarily about hoaxers and denialists, and try to bait and switch you into then seeing their broader worldview. And they're welcome to have the worldview. I mean, people had to have their own politics and make movies that are in line with their politics. But those politics are subject to critique. And that's what I try to do in my own piece.
So, I mean, I would just say that, that first of all, again, as a conservative, I think I'm probably much more practiced at divorcing the political ideology and agenda from the actual piece of work. And so I'm just judging this on the merits of whether I liked it or not. And I did. But I would never listen to another Bruce Springsteen song if I let, that get to me. And the interpretation that you just laid out there, like, that is so hidden that I went in. So I am a guy who works in politics for a living. I went into the movie expecting a propagandistic global warming agenda, and I didn't see it. I didn't see the metaphor that you just laid out. Now, I think certainly that would be like one, if I were like a college professor, like, that would be like one and one of the themes or one possible interpretation. It did not hit me over the head. And so either
there are other things in the movie that are far more blunt and not subtle, but I agree that was not one of them.
Right. And so I guess, either I'm really stupid, which is possible, or they didn't do their job of making it a propaganda film, or they did such a good job as to be like almost subliminal, as to be undetectable by me, but to have subconsciously influenced me.
Well, I mean,
those are probably the three options.
The initial article I wanted to write, which I pitched to my editor, I didn't want to watch it. I got my thing with Sirota. I knew I couldn't watch the film objectively. I didn't want to write like a whiny, grouchy piece, like, fueled by the animus. It just wouldn't be a good piece. And so I wanted to do a piece about how you just can't expect movies to move the political needle like that. We should all remember Fahrenheit 9/11, when people thought we're really going to defeat George Bush through a Michael Moore movie. And even though that was an enormous, financial success, it didn't move the political needle at all. And, this is at minimum a Netflix success. It's one of the most streamed Netflix movies of all time. It's hard to.
But I would say that. I would say that it's a mistake to try to move the political needle on an election. But long term, if you believe that politics is downstream from culture, then I think that movies and entertainment does. I mean, Will and Grace, The Cosby Show, these are examples of how over time they can help, for better or worse, but they can help change public perception.
I agree with the Cosby and Will and Grace examples. But I think in this case, it misses what and this gets to my whole critique of the politics of the movie, the climate change challenge. This is one of the most vexing political problems you could have. You have a genuine threat to the planet that is hard to convey its imminence because it's not like a comet. It doesn't wipe out the planet in an instant. The effects are gradual over time. And even some of the most severe impacts don't, one, either people don't automatically connect it to climate change or see it as distant or see it as adaptable, see it as not really affecting them directly. And the solutions to it are not, there's not a cut and dry, this policy is the solution, this policy isn't the solution. There's a myriad of things that you could do. There's all sorts of interesting debates.
Fly into outer space, if we could like fly into outer space and blow up, you know, a comet, I think a lot of us would be on board with that. You know what I mean? Like, that sounds pretty fun to me.
You know, one thing that I thought could have done that didn't do is, I mean, in reality, if you proposed blowing a comet off course with a nuke, you'd get some controversy around that. Like, you would not see instant unanimity on the left of like putting a nuke into space. There would be some blowback to that proposal.
That's a good point. If they had more time, they could have done that and had like, you know, anti-nuke protesters who don't want to stop the comet because they're anti-nuke.
So
that would have been good.
So I just think that
you can't do everything.
The movie's message is we have a problem, and if we just had the will and the focus, we'd solve it. That completely misses how complicated the problem is. And that's also why it's one thing for the Cosby Show to get into white people's heads, hey, black people can have normal middle-class lives, or to show Will and Grace, say, hey, gay people can have loving long-term relationships and should have the same marriage as everybody else. You know, those are more simple points to convey. The climate change challenge is so much more complicated than that, and you're not going to solve it with the movie.
Well, I mean, first of all, I disagree with the premise, in a sense, that this is even about climate change. But that's a lot of pressure to put on a movie. Like, I would say this, if your criteria for whether this movie succeeds or not is based on whether it causes people to suddenly change dramatically and start battling climate change, then on that criteria, the movie will fail. If, however, it's about, is it entertaining? Is it fun? And does it raise questions that will get you thinking about a whole bunch of things in our culture? You know, including the big tech utopianism, then I think it succeeds dramatically.
Well, and so objectively speaking,
we're just judging it on different criteria.
Objectively speaking, a lot of people have seen the movie, and a lot of people have written about the movie. A lot of people have talked about the movie as a conversation generator. It is unquestionably a success. I mean, I don't think that's not even a subjective point. It just is. I don't get the vibe from the things that the creators have said publicly that that's what they wanted to get out of this. I think they wanted to this movie to have a bigger impact than just that.
I benefit by virtue of having heard nothing that they've said. Somehow I got the message that this was supposed to be about global warming, and that's why I didn't watch it for a week or two. But that was sort of like, I heard that, like, I don't know how I heard it, and it was like I couldn't escape it. But I have not heard a single thing intentionally that was said about the movie. And so I am very divorced from like what the creators wanted this movie to do. I'm judging it solely by the merits of the art itself. And so it's a different perspective.
Let's shift gears. That's probably more than anyone wanted to hear about Don't Look Up.
You never know.
It's Tuesday, day after Martin Luther King Day, Senate back in session. Democrats are prepared to do a full court press on voting rights. Still not clear, at least at this taping, what exactly they're going to do procedurally. I wrote a piece last week making the point that, we know that there are 50 votes for the Democratic bills. but there are not 50 votes for the procedural rule changes that would allow the bills to become law, or at least clear the Senate with 50 votes. Because Manchin and Sinema said they won't change the filibuster through a nuclear option parliamentary procedure. And the point that I made this in the past, but I did it more prominently last week, is, you know, there's some debate whether Democrats should try to do a filibuster carve out that would say the filibuster doesn't apply to voting rights bills or bills that have that involve the protection of constitutional rights. And some other folks that want to go a bit short of that and say, hey, let's just change the rules so we can have a talking filibuster, not a silent filibuster. And point I was making is, you don't need to change the rules to have a talking filibuster. There's no silent filibuster rule. That's a misnomer. The reason why we used to have talking filibusters and now we have silent filibusters is that in 1970, the majority leader created a system, which is called double tracking, where if you have a bill that's being filibustered, because typically you have a bill on the floor, if it's being filibustered, you can't do anything else on the floor. That was the old way. Whatever's on the floor is on the floor, and that's it. And at this point, a lot of senators like, this is really giving up the works. Bill's talking, we can't get stuff done here on here. So Mike Mansfield, the majority leader, said, okay, can I have unanimous consent that we take this filibuster bill, put it to the side, and go talk about some other bill right now? And everyone's like, yes, finally, we can talk about something else. Absolutely, let's go do that. And that began the era of the silent filibuster. It wasn't a change in the rule. It was done through existing rule. So all you have to do to have a talking filibuster is not ask for unanimous consent to move to another bill. And this was done in 1988 with an election reform bill, a campaign finance bill. Robert Byrd, who is often seen as the protector of the filibuster, he went on the floor and said, let's not have an easygoing filibuster in the back rooms. Let's have it out here in front of the cameras where everybody can see it. And they had that for 4 days. And in fact, not only was it filibustered, but Republicans tried to drag things out by denying quorum. They would have a quorum call. They would leave one Republican on the floor, and everyone else would go scurry away. So Republicans didn't cede control of the floor to the Democrats completely, where they could do a quick vote. But they didn't have quorum; they couldn't do other business. And the Democrats voted to have the sergeant at arms arrest the fugitive senators and drag them back to the floor. In fact, Bob Packwood famously was accosted in his office. He tried to barricade the door, couldn't barricade all the doors, literally was picked up and carried into the Senate feet first. If you read my piece, you actually have, I don't have video of the carrying, but I do have video of what happened right afterwards when Byrd and Packwood had a little colloquy talking about him getting carried back in. So you can click and see that video. So Democrats gonna do it right now. And
maybe the House, January 6th commission subpoena could take a page from this method.
Now, Tim Kaine is actively promoting this strategy. We don't know if Schumer's going to do it yet, but they actually could do this. And I think, so the question is if I was starting from scratch, I mean, you've heard me about voting rights a million times, that I don't see it with the same level, through the same prism as the Democrats are seeing it. I don't see it as, if we can't pass this, we're never going to win another election again, because I think these bills are going to work in ways that both parties don't anticipate based on existing data and historical patterns. It's not about helping Democrats help Republicans in reality, even though they might think it is.
Why going back to 2018 or whatever, why would going back to the way elections were run in 2018 mean Democrats can never win again? I don't know.
Democrats did great in 2018 and 2020, and Glenn Youngkin won in Virginia, a state that now has very liberal voting laws because Democrats have run the state for the past several years. So anyway, so I wouldn't be in the pickle Democrats are in, because I wouldn't have I wouldn't have treated this as existential and gotten the base so hopped up on it. But they are where they are. So
yeah.
Do you have a single vote to change the rules that loses because two Democrats at least, you know, break ranks, and then you shrug your shoulder and say, hey, we try, let's do the next thing now? Or do you put your foot to the, you know, put your foot on the gas and say, we're going to be on this floor no matter how long it takes. Nothing else matters. We're going to make all the arguments, and Republicans are going to fight us. Well, everyone's going to see it. Look, you may still lose. You probably will lose. But
yeah.
But you could at least say, hey, we fought it and we put the spotlight on it. We tried to rally the public around it. And like, what are you holding up? What other bill is in the wings that you're not getting to because of this? There's nothing in the wings. I mean, judicial nominations wouldn't get dealt with.
But what's the exit strategy, right? Like, I assume Republicans would not break, that they would enjoy this publicity. At some point, the Democrats would have to give, presumably, if they ever want to pass anything. So then they would be backing down, right?
Here's what I think the exit strategy is. You have a bipartisan group that has come together to talk about election integrity, Election Count Act, and maybe a few other provisions. You know, and whether they can actually get to 60 votes with that, I can't say yet. But you have some Republicans saying, we are interested in talking about this. Mitch McConnell has said, I'm happy to talk Electoral Count Act. Susan Collins, I think she has 5 Republicans in the group right now. That's a start. That's more of a thread to pull than anything else I see out there. And if you got like a 2-month filibuster going where nobody can get anything done, I mean, maybe there's some ticky-tack things the Republicans want to do for their home states that they can't get done, it puts some pressure on the negotiations to produce something in as short an order as possible, certainly before you get into the summer when it gets even harder to get things done because you're getting into election season.
But couldn't Democrats just try to skip the quote-unquote voting rights bills that they're pushing that wouldn't have stopped Trump from a coup? And couldn't they just actually focus on the electoral vote?
Where we are. I mean, I wouldn't.
Why go through?
I would not have painted myself into this corner in the first place, but the Democrats are in this corner. So how do you get out of the corner? I would say have a protracted filibuster while encouraging these bipartisan talks. Yeah, you're not going to get Freedom to Vote Act out of it. But if you get something out of it, you can say, hey, you know what? We gave a little, they gave a little. This process was productive. It wasn't a waste of everybody's time. We fought as hard as we could, and this is what we got out of it. I mean, people can be disappointed because you didn't get everything, but there's no way out of that pickle. So I think that's the best strategy that's available.
I think Democrats have made a ton of mistakes, and I do not understand their logic, their rationale for a lot of things they've done, including, you know, the way that they handled Build Back Better and the bipartisan infrastructure bill and going back to the COVID relief bill. I mean, how about let's withdraw from Afghanistan? What could go wrong? It just all the stuff they've done everything I would have told them not to do. And I agree. Like, so after Build Back Better fails, their move is let's do something else that'll fail. Let's tackle another bill we can't pass. Right. Like, I don't get the logic of that. But having said that, at this point, your strategy is as good as any other, or probably better than what they're going to do.
Well, this might be what they do. You know, I mean, I'm not saying they do it because I wrote it, but I mean, at least Tim Kaine and some others are telling Schumer, hey, do the talking filibuster, and the bipartisan group is in existence. I mean, so these two things might actually happen.
You should take credit if it happens. And let me say this on a totally different note. The Washington football team is apparently going to change their name again. And one of the names being bandied about has something to do with the Hogs, which I have been championing for like a decade. I've written a couple times about they should change the name. If they're going to change the name from the Redskins, they should go to the Hogs. And they could have like a tough, like a badass looking boar with like, I would put a little feather just to pay an homage to the old name. But the Hogs, which harkens back to like the offensive line from those great 1980s Redskins teams. And now I've started to hear that there may be a name that incorporates hogs into it. And so I think if that happens,
they should be the should be the Washington Pork.
Well, actually, I was rooting for the Washington Reagans, but that's not apparently not going to be the pick. So,
we've talked a good long while. But was there any other topic you've written about lately that you wanted to get to?
Well, I don't think there's anything we need to discuss. I would promote a couple pieces that I wrote at the Daily Beast. One is about I watched Trump's rally in Arizona. And I wrote about how it really didn't break through the way in the past his rallies used to really drive media narratives. And I raised some questions about the jumping of the shark. So check that out. And I wrote a piece about Nancy Pelosi, who is opposing bipartisan efforts that would prohibit members of Congress and their families from betting in the stock market. You know, you could still have like mutual funds or things that are managed, blind trusts or whatever, but you could not own individual stock, buy and sell individual stock. Nancy Pelosi opposes this, even though a lot of Democrats, including John Ossoff and Mark Kelly and Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and Elizabeth Warren, want to pass this law. I actually agree with them. Believe it or not, I think Pelosi's wrong. And I call attention to some of the more egregious examples of how Nancy Pelosi profited on the market, including, things that that look very interesting, that she was able to get in on some deals. So check out that column at The Beast.
Well, let me ask you briefly about the Trump rally. Yeah. Because we also have this Trump DeSantis feud simmering.
Yes.
DeSantis went on a podcast that's hosted by someone who's close to McConnell, and NBC said this talk that Trump really McConnell's pulling the strings and trying to elevate DeSantis and block Trump from the nomination. DeSantis refuses to rule out running against Trump. Trump is saying, "You're betraying me because I made you," which I think Trump has got a point there. I mean, DeSantis was trailing in the gubernatorial primary in 2018 until he got the Trump endorsement. I mean, there's this one guy Trump can't actually take credit for making. I do think it's DeSantis. But do you
ironic, isn't it?
Do you think that the rally is evidence that Trump's hold on the party is actually weakening, or is that just wishful thinking? And sure, maybe you didn't get the media punch he would have liked, but don't kid yourself, he still is, you know, by miles the leader of this party.
I mean, I think all of it's true. I think that DeSantis poses a legitimate threat. I think that clearly Trump is not able to drive media attention and narratives and news cycles the way he used to. And I also think he still is clearly the front runner for the Republican nomination if he wants it. So it's a complicated, messy world, but I think all those things are sort of true.
But do you think there's a chance Trump runs for the nomination and does not win the primary?
Yes.
Are you willing to put like a percentage on that, or you're not there yet?
20%.
All right. Okay.
So I think DeSantis. No. Okay. So here's the theory, right? If you're DeSantis, you look at recent history. Recent history says when you're hot, and when you're not, right? So Obama made the right call when he ran, when he did. Chris Christie made the wrong call. Joe Biden should have run in 2016, but Trump made the right call when he ran in 2016, in the sense of when you have a moment and there's a window of time and you have to seize the day. And so I think if you're DeSantis, you could make an argument. It's like go big or go home, right? Like if you really want to be president, your odds are probably better if you know, the odds are still slim, but you have a better chance if that's your goal, if you run this time when the stars align. Now, if you lose, it's worse than just a normal loss. It's a crushing, humiliating loss because Trump will destroy you, right? And so that is a calculation that I would not want to have to make. But politicians are egomaniacs, and DeSantis seems more egotistical than most. And so I would not rule out the possibility that he takes a shot.
If DeSantis really wants to run for president, maybe it's not like a huge risk. I think there is a risk of him losing the governor's race this year. I mean, his approval numbers are not gangbusters. They're okay. He's leading, I think.
By the way, let me just say, he's running this as Nikki Fried or Freed or something.
I think it's Freed, but
she's putting out tweets that I've seen that are really irresponsible. Have you seen some of the stuff she's been
tweeting? I have. I'm not sure what you're referring to.
All right. I'm not equipped to like prosecute this case, but the contrast doesn't seem to me that it's like the good, responsible Democrat versus the crazy Republican. She, and again, I can't sort of buttress this with any evidence right now, but my perception has been that she's been tweeting some kind of like irresponsible stuff.
Like I can't speak to it. You know, she's behind Charlie Crist in the Democratic primary right now. So she's got to make some noise to catch up. I think sort of average political, insider wisdom is that Crist would have a better shot than Freed.
Well, and people forget Charlie Crist was once a wildly popular governor of Florida.
Yeah.
And there was a time when his approval ratings must have been like in the 80s or something, right? I mean, he was really popular at one point. And that's part of the reason that nobody thought Marco Rubio could beat him.
Right, right. So anyway, I think there's a non-zero chance that DeSantis loses that race, which would, I think, totally doom any shot of running for president. And so I wonder if I'm DeSantis. I don't think he's going to do this, but. What do you think? We're just to run for president now. So why take a gamble in 2022? Just jump in the presidential race now and go big or go home.
Well, if we've learned anything from recent years, it's that we live in interesting times and crazy things happen, and nothing would surprise me. And if DeSantis were to beat Trump, and part of his strategy apparently is to out COVID him. To basically say Trump's not tough enough on being, Trump is saying, it's don't look up, right? Or whatever, like Trump's not a big enough COVID denier.
Yeah, at one point,
Trump isn't anti-masking enough.
Trump has said, I'll tell you got the vaccine, and he won't. He said DeSantis by name, but there was a wink, wink. DeSantis has been squirreling about whether he's taken it or not, and Trump hasn't. Kristi Noem, the South Dakota governor, at one point gave a speech last summer where she was implicitly digging DeSantis for being too weak on COVID.
Oh yeah,
that he claims they didn't do lockdowns and he did. I mean, again, not using him by name, but the clear wink, wink, because she made reference to beaches, which we all know refers to Florida. But I think to most people, DeSantis has been as libertarian as you can possibly get. But I even say fully libertarian. Because he's banning localities from doing their own mandates, by trying to make it so every individual can do what they want to do, and I think that is, and he's bet his one of the reasons why he's where he is right now is that there's a lot of currency for that position in Republican quarters.
Yeah, and look, he's younger than Trump, he's more relevant than Trump in the sense that he's an elected official. He's the governor of Florida, and he's tough, and he has what Trump offers in terms of toughness and fighting, being willing to fight and take down the media. So like, in a sense, if you're a MAGA person or if you're a Trumpy person, like maybe you could buy into the argument that like Trump was great, but somehow he's not the president anymore. And so let's go with a younger version, like a new model. Let's trade him in for a new model, a younger model. So, again, I'm not betting that would happen, but I think there's a chance it could.
Let's leave it on that note. I think I've plugged everything that I have to plug in this world. Anything else you want to mention?
Nope. Just, you know, check out our Twitter feed at DMZ Show.
All right. And we'll catch you next week.
All right. See you guys. Bye.